Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. It's a great pleasure to be doing this show today, and I've got two very, very interesting guests on for the show today. I've had Damon Crowe on with us for the first hour, and Damon is still with us for the second hour, but my second hour guest is Jarra White, who is known to many people on YouTube. He's done an incredible series of YouTube video investigations of the Apollo moon landing hoax, as Jarra would put it. And Jarra was inspired by some of the early researchers in this topic, which I'm sure he'll fill us in on. And he took it further and has really done a lot of his own independent research. And he's actually now studying for a degree in astrophysics, which I greatly admire. And I really give the thumbs up to that, because it shows a degree of dedication to this subject. Jarra, it's been a while since you've been on our show. Welcome back, mate.
Great to be back again.
Yeah, well, indeed. Now, Jarra, for our listeners, we have a number of radio stations picking us up now in the US. Could you just basically give us a recap of how you came to be who you are? I think it's just very important just to go through your background and the story of your research.
Well, I was always a fan of space exploration and astronomy in general when I was a child, and I always dreamed of one day being the first man on Mars. And some years later, during my teenage years, I first learned of the moon hoax conspiracy theory. I took it with a grain of salt, but I decided to investigate it. You know, let's see what these guys are saying about this. And I looked at their research, and I referred back to everything that I had learned previously about space, and it just blew my mind when I realized, oh my God, this is just simply we never went to the moon. This is impossible. And of course, during my search, I came across many. Pro-NASA websites and articles and the like, basically trying to propagate the idea that the moon missions were real. All these websites, they generally, rather than providing actual scientific data, they would just normally try to pull the wool over their readers' eyes by clouding them with smoke and mirrors, if you will. Instead of a lot of the times they would resort to straw man arguments, or they would misrepresent the facts. They would downplay the numbers, or they would downplay the information. And after Bill Kasing died, and he was just constantly trolled by these individuals, and I finally got pissed off enough that I felt it was time for somebody to take a stand. And I started writing up this enormous essay. This was an enormous essay debunking every single pro NASA website point by point. And let me tell you, I held nothing back. I was really angry writing all this stuff. And by the time it's finished, it was a few heaps of information, size of a phone book. And I'm looking back through it, and I think, okay, maybe I shouldn't have, because by this stage I had calmed down, you know. It was raw emotions, really, very, very raw emotions, and I didn't really hold back, did nothing to hide my anger about it. And so when I figured, oh, maybe I should tone that down here, you know, because people were more likely to listen to you if you have a level head about yourself. And around this time, I had done my film and TV course, and I was thinking, okay, well, maybe I should, rather than probably, even after I turned it down, it was still way too huge. And I thought, well, maybe, why don't I just produce these into a series of videos? And that's how the Moonfaker series came about. Of course, during my research, I became friends with Ralph Rene, who was the person who wrote the book NASA Mooned America. Indeed. He was a ex-member of Mensa, the High IQ Society, and he had been contacted by the RAND Corporation for any free ideas for space travel. And he wrote them back with a few ideas. He never heard back from them. They never said thank you. They never confirmed reception or anything like that. And about 1990, he received this huge glossy government printing office book called The America at the Threshold, which was this propaganda document touting this manned Mars mission for $1 trillion. And he was reading through it, looking at the pages in there, looking at the drawings and whatnot. And he finally gets to page A51 in the appendix, which is a whole list of all these names, all these consultants, all these contributors, basically all people who had contributed towards this Mars mission thing. And he finds his name smack dab in the middle of it, because apparently at least one of the ideas that he had sent them had been approved for this manned Mars mission. By this stage, he had picked up on Bill Kasing's book. Bill Kasing, he was the a service engineer at Rocketdyne. He had wrote a number of technical reports and had witnessed many of their testing. Rocketdyne was the company that built the engines on the Saturn V, the F1s and the J2s, and he was privy to a lot of clandestine activities that had gone down at the time, like the Apollo Simulation Project, which was a program to go about simulating flights to the moon and purporting them to be the real thing.
Can I just interject very briefly, Jared, there? Well, Bill Kaysing has been obviously a big focus of a lot of Apollo researchers, and I've come across a lot of stuff about Bill Kaysing, and I just wanted to just get your opinion on this, because it's been said that he was not a scientist and that he was actually a librarian with a degree in the arts. Can you just comment on that? Because I know you said he was a service engineer, so I'm just trying to clarify a point there.
Well, he was. He worked as the head of technical publications at Rocketdyne, but during his career, right, he started out as a writer, worked his way up as a service engineer and a service analyst, and I forget the last title he had, but it's all written on he has a letter from Rocketdyne, which confirms his history there, confirms which titles he held.
Oh, really? And, that's very interesting.
Yeah,
okay.
And basically he would work as a technical consultant for all these things, and would go on to write reports about this, about the test that he'd witnessed to, and this is what's been happening. This is everything we've done. Here's the technical report on that. And so he worked in all these programs during that time at Rocketdyne, and he left in 1963, and because he felt that he didn't want to be part of this anymore. There was a lot of cover ups, a lot of crazy shit going on down there.
Yeah.
And so he just didn't want any part of it anymore, and he left in 1963. He didn't even bother to watch the moon landings after because he knew it wasn't going to be taking place. He was, as I said, he was privy to the whole Apollo simulation project thing. And he knew all their plans and everything else, but just couldn't generate enthusiasm for watching what he called a phony performance. And he kept this information bottled up inside, and because he was always there to help his fellow man, he would invite, take people off the street. Because he found a lot of homeless people, and he would give them shelter and food and stuff at his houseboat. Offer them accommodation. And one such person was a fellow by the name of John Grant, who was a former soldier who fought in Vietnam, and his time in Vietnam had made him become a heroin addict. And one night he and Kaysing were talking, and he says, "Bill, I was conned by the U.S. government in believing that what I did was patriotic, but I was going sent there to kill a lot of innocent Vietnamese with no good reason at all, and so that what they convinced me to do was bullshit." And he says, why didn't you blow the whistle on this rotten, corrupt government?" And he was proposing writing it, doing a satire. He says, why didn't you say something outrageous like we never went to the moon? Of course, Grant was proposing doing a satirical project, but Kaysing ended up doing a serious book. Went public with all his inside knowledge about the Apollo simulation project, the photographic analysis that he had, like with the lack of a crater underneath the lander, and he also learned of Thomas Ronald Barron, who was the safety inspector during the construction of the Apollo 1 spacecraft. And he had this Barron fellow, he had compiled this 500-page document detailing all these safety violations, these problems, and all these technical issues that went into the construction of Apollo. And he testified that he didn't believe that they were going to get to the moon. What happens 3 days later, he's found dead at a railroad crossing where his car got hit by a train. Killed him, his wife and his stepdaughter, and his body was never autopsied, was just promptly cremated. That sent some alarm bells ringing there in Kaysing's head, and so he went public with all this information in his book, "We Never Went to the Moon." Now, his book was more of a personal inside journal, I guess, of this is everything that went down at Rocketdyne. This is what the plan was. This is the evidence for it. But it led to a lot of the technical information, like radiation and the like. And well, Renee, after he found that NASA was using his name to promote their upcoming Mars mission, he went to the library, got all these books allegedly written by these space heroes, and other books written by various scientists who were either astronomers or one way or another connected with NASA. And he sat down and started reading all these books, all these articles and stuff. And the more he read through these books, it became it became clear to him that they went nowhere. When they first contacted him, Rand Corporation, when they first contacted him, he was a believer in the moon landings. After he sent them his documents, he began to have his doubts here and there, like he saw the flag waving, and he picked up on Bill Kaysing's book. Oh, this is interesting. He started getting... Oh, this is really cool. And so yeah. When they started using his name, without telling him that they had approved his plans for a Mars mission, now they were going to use him, which he knows that, okay, we couldn't get to the moon back then. How are we going to get there now? And now you're using my name to promote your spurious programs, right? He went to the library, got all this information, and then once he got all the, he was writing down notes as he was going through it. Right, because when he wrote a number of alternative science books before he actually started doubting the moon landings, right? And when he first presented all his alternative science theories, everyone said, "Well, where's your references? This is stuff that we've been studying for all these generations. So why do I need references for? Oh, no one's going to believe you about references." So this time, as he was reading through all these space books, he was jotting down references for this and for that. And when he got all this information, he called up Bill Casey and he said, "Bill, this is what I've got on all this, on NASA, this, that. And then finally, when it's all done, Casey says, "Well, why don't you write it into a book? If you do, I'll publish it." "Okay, sure." He wrote up the book and he submitted it to Casey. And while he was writing it, he was getting more and more information, obviously. And Bill Casey was impressed, of course. Casey never published it because he had to use the money to pay for his wife's medical bills. And, it just fell through. Then he got in touch with another guy called Jimmy Collier. He was interested in publishing it, but that fell through too. And so finally the book was self-published. And after Rene died, in 2008, I soon acquired the copyrights to the book. And so I'm proud to keep his book still in print.
Great. Yeah. And I can see, would you say that Bill Kaysing was probably the main influence on you initially?
Yeah, he was the main influence on me as well. What really motivated me to really become this defender of Kaysing, this defender of Rene, was the way Kaysing was treated by these propagandists. In dead, when he's no longer able to defend himself, even when he was alive, they were they're saying all this spurious stuff about him. And yes. these pro NASA individuals, they couldn't be truthful if their lives depended on it. Like one of the things that stands out in my mind, Damon, you're talking about the reptiles and stuff. I believe I was the first to bring this up in the whole thing. One of the things that these pro-NASA guys kept citing was the Zonda 5 mission, which was the Russian flight that took turtles and also bacteria and some species of plants and some insects aboard there. All these species were radiation hardy, right? And yet the propagandists, they would constantly cite this Zonda 5 mission as the definitive proof that man can survive the mission to the moon. Not one of them even mentioned the difference between the two. In fact, nowadays it's believed that they can use turtle blood to actually cure radiation sickness in humans. If you go onto Google, you can do a search on tortoise blood fights radiation sickness, and you'll
find. We're just going to break. Okay. We'll be right back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. We're talking to Jarrah White about his research into the Apollo moon landing hoax. Very interesting material, ladies and gentlemen. Please stay with us.
You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia, going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now.
Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. We're talking to Jarrah White, and I have Damon Crowe with me in the studio tonight. And the subject is the question of manned space travel to the moon and beyond. Jarrah has been going through his kind of journey of discovery and breaking through some of the mainstream views and myths about what really happened. And we were talking there about Bill Kaysing, a very, very important figure for Apollo researchers. Did you want to quickly recap there on who Bill Kaysing was? Jerry, you said you had some extra info there.
Yes, I've got the. I mentioned before the break that he had a letter from Rocketdyne to confirm what jobs he had at the company.
Oh, great!
Looking at that letter, it's printed in his book. Okay, he was hired in February of 1956. When he was first hired, he worked as a senior technical writer. Then in September of that same year, he was promoted to service analyst.
Okay.
Then in 1958, he worked as a service engineer. And then finally in 62,
so that was actually his title. His title was service engineer.
That's his actual title, yes.
Yeah, that's very important.
Yes, and then finally in 1962, he became a publications analyst. And he quit for personal reasons in 1963. Now, many propagandists, they even tried to strip that away from Kaysing by denying what a service engineer was. They likened it to, they said, oh, it's like calling a janitor a sanitation engineer. Really lit me up.
That's ridiculous.
I contacted Rocketdyne themselves, right, just to confirm what nature a service engineer was. And the fellow, I forget his name right now, but I've got a whole video about that, which I showed my communications with Rocketdyne. Okay, and they confirmed that this service engineer would be responsible for checking and acting as a technical support consultant for all these launches, these preparations and everything else. You can look it up. You can go onto my YouTube channel. You can do a search on the video, Bill Kaysing, the service engineer. That puts it into perspective.
The name is not used lightly. The word engineer is not thrown around lightly. Obviously, it is a term that is used to designate a level of technical competence. And these debunkers really discredit themselves by using this ad hominem style of argument. Whenever I see an ad hominem style argument used, it makes me completely question. It makes me completely incredulous about the argument that's being put forward. It's a really, really low, cheap tactic that is used again and again simply to try and win an argument. Good on you, mate, for actually clarifying there about who Bill Kaysing was. Yeah. Now, continue.
Yeah, and of course, after I got involved in the whole moon hoax conspiracy movement, I became number one on the hit list, especially after Ralph Rene died, because I was the only one on YouTube anyways who knew Rene personally. And I was constantly defending Bill Kaysing, and I was a personal friend of Rene, and I was just trolled like you wouldn't believe. And to be perfectly frank with you, I honestly stopped caring what these trolls say about me personally a long time ago. And because I'll tell you why, is because I consider them to be the human centipede. All they do is they feed shit to their followers, who in turn feed the same recycled shit to others.
Okay. Now, continue. Well, sorry.
Yeah, well, getting back to what I was saying just before the break, I mentioned one of the main things that they kept bringing up was the Zonda 5 mission. These pro-NASA individuals, they kept citing Zonda 5 as proof that the radiation in space, in cislunar space, was and the Van Allen belts was harmless to turtles. Sorry, to harmless to humans. Right, and they said, "Oh, these turtles—they can survive, so therefore humans can survive." Well, the turtle, a human can take 500 rem, then it will die. Okay, whereas a turtle, they will take anything from 15,000 rads to 80,000 rads. Sorry, 40,000 rads. I'm looking at the paper right here, and in fact, there's a UPI article on the internet called "Tortoise Blood Fights Radiation Sickness," in which they found that they can actually use turtle blood, the amino acids in the turtle blood, to actually cure radiation sickness in humans. Right, so that is testament to just how radiation hardy they are compared to humans. That's like saying that a human can survive the radiation of space simply because a turtle can survive is like saying that you can survive getting shot in the face because Superman can get shot in the face and survive.
Yeah, it's ludicrous. And you know, testing is not done with reptiles. When we're testing any kind of chemical, drug or environmental effects, we don't test them on reptiles. We test them on mammals, right? So mice or preferably monkeys. I might get Damon to basically chime in now. Damon, I know you've got a lot to talk about with Jaron. We've only got, a bit over half the show left. So why don't you just chime in and just take over.
Yeah, I just wanted to add a couple of things that I forgot. It's so hard trying to summarise things in such a short period of time, but I forgot to mention that in this radiation report of 1963 from Russia, they said, whatever you do, don't go in the middle of a solar maximum. And that's, in fact, exactly what they did. But the other interesting thing that I learnt throughout the last year or so of studying this is that the solar minimum is kind of you can't go on a solar maximum because the unpredictable solar flares, but in a solar minimum, because of the heliosphere produced by the sun is reduced, then you're more affected by cosmic radiation. So you can't win either way in a solar maximum or a solar minimum. But Jarrah has some pretty good information on solar flares. And if you ever see a projection of the 60s and the 70s with the solar flares that happened throughout that period, and then have a look at the interwoven missions from, say, Apollo 7 through to Apollo 17, they were dodging bullets all over the place, weren't they, Jarrah? I mean, this thing was like running the gauntlet. Have you seen this of image, Jarrah? I'm sure you have, where you have a look at the solar flares over the period of sort of 68 to 72 and interwoven with the appropriate Apollo missions in the same time.
Yeah, that's correct. Renee, he actually has a whole chapter about that in his NASA Moon to America book. He had to when he first started writing his NASA Moon to America book, he contacted the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA for short, for any solar data that they would have, and he would specifically ask for X-ray data and proton data, but they would give him the runaround every now and then. The data they did send him, right, it showed that there was 1,400 solar flares between the Apollo program and my friend Rick. He recently found the comprehensive flare index for major flares. Now that list is no longer on the website, unfortunately. But I got it printed off before they took it down. I mean, the link for it is still up there, but it's a dead link now. Anyways, that list shows that there was 30 of these major flares during that time. Now, the reason this is important is because even the propagandists, they say only the major solar flares can hurt you or even kill you, right? And they adamantly deny that there were any major solar flares during the Apollo program, and yet we've got this paper that lists all these major solar flares from 1955 to 1980, right? And it shows that 30 of those flares, these major flares, occurred during the Apollo program. And even if there were no major solar flares, even the minor flares are still a bit of a hazard. There was a book in 1963 written by various scientists at the Marshall Space Flight Center, and it documents the dangers of all types of solar flares. There's a chart printed in the book. It's actually, I posted that chart on my website, moonfaker.com. You can find it in the frequently asked questions page. Okay, it shows how much water you would need to shield yourself against, to bring the doses of these minor flares down to 25 rems per hour. Okay, a minor flare can require anything from 2 grams per square centimeter of water to even 30 grams of that, because these flares, it depends on the energy of these flares and also the flux of them. Even a low energy flare can deliver 25 rem per hour if you have enough centimeters of water stopping this. And these densities are just much greater than what they had on the Apollo program.
So a small flare would have increased the, say, Apollo 11 absorbed radiation dose by a factor of 100.
That's correct. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying that the debunking of these radiation figures, I've excluded the Van Allen radiation belts, where there is no evidence that there's any mammal that's ever survived that. And the secondary radiation that you've indicated in there. Anyway, look, I've done the figures and excluded the vellum radiation belts and solar flares, and the figures still don't add up.
We're just going to break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. We're talking to Jarrah White about the Apollo moon landing hoax. Don't go away. Thank you. are you with Truth News Radio Australia? It's great to be with you today. We are talking about the Apollo moon hoax with Jarrah White. Now, when I say the Apollo moon hoax, I'm not stating that as a categorical fact that it was a hoax. I simply look at this with an open mind. I know certain people have made up their minds, and it's important that people who do a lot of research have a very clear view of what they know, what they believe to be fact. I think Jarrah is certain that the moon landings are a hoax. I think Damon is. I'm trying to just be a vehicle here for the communication of that knowledge. I know a lot of people dispute this. I know a lot of people think that this is a pointless field of inquiry. I really think that's completely wrong. I think you, if you think that way, you need to step back a little and analyze your own mindset on it. If you think it's not important, why do you think it's not important? Space travel is an incredibly important thing for the future of human civilization. And if you look at the planet, we look at where we are now, and a lot of people talk about overpopulation as being a big problem. We certainly have populated this planet to an incredible degree. And like any form of growth and development, the next stage is something we have to be thinking about. And logically, the next stage of human development, of human civilization, is to move beyond this one sphere that we currently live on. And we need to know whether we can do that or not. It's a very important thing. Like, it's probably one of the most important things for the future of humanity, to know whether we can leave this planet or not. And that's actually something that I'd like to get into you, Jarrah, if we have time. But, Jarrah, let's just continue from where we left off there. We're still talking about radiation. Radiation being the major question, the major inhibiting factor. And there are certain, little known aspects of radiation that I think you would like to highlight for us.
Yes, it's one thing that Damon mentioned was my video on the secondary radiation in the belt. That video in question, it's called Moonfaker Radioactive Anomaly 2. That's a Roman numeral 2, part 3. Okay, and in that video, right, I give the calculations for the secondary radiation. You see, as the electrons are brought to a stop, they lose their energy in the form of X-rays, or that's called the Bremsstrahlung radiation. Right, in that video, I did the calculations for we know what the fluxes are, and we know what the energies are. The energies in the out of an Allen belt, they range from 10 to 100 mega electron volts. Right, and the fluxes are 40,000 particles per square centimeter per second. It'd be very, very complicated to just talk about all the calculations on the radio here, but I encourage you to go check out that video and see for yourself. The short answer is that for 10 MeV electrons, you would get 136 rems per hour, right? And for 100 MeV electrons, you would get 1,360 rem per hour. That's just from the secondary X-rays. That's just from the secondary X-rays.
Now remember, they reported 0.18 rem over 8 days. So what Jarrah's indicating here is that in certain parts of the belt, you get up to 1,300 rem in 1 hour. Now, remember, it takes you a number of hours to get through the radiation belt. So this secondary emission absolutely debunks the whole idea you can go to the moon just trying to traverse the radiation belts, which is why there is not a single recorded, publicly available experiment involving a mammal through the radiation belts. Only a reptile has ever survived that transition. That is a known fact.
Yeah. Another thing too, you mentioned as well earlier on the show how the IMAX films, they needed to be protected with bags of water. The another one thing that comes to my mind as well was the The photographs taken by the Lunar Orbiter spacecrafts. Prior to the Apollo missions, NASA had specifically sent the Lunar Orbiter, these were five unmanned missions, they were called Lunar Orbiters. They sent five unmanned missions there to map the moon down to 1 meter resolution. I was about to say 1 meter per pixel, but they weren't using digital films back then, they were using film. But the films that they had to use on the Lunar Orbiter things, they had to bring a very special, radiation hardy type of film. I forget what it's called right now, but it's funny how they bring this radiation hardy film to the moon on the unmanned Lunar Orbiter missions. Yet on Apollo they bring ordinary film.
That's fascinating. When was the Lunar Orbiter missions? When were they?
That was between 1966 and 1967. These missions resolved all six moon landing sites prior to the Apollo missions. You see, many propagandists have been, in recent years, they've been citing pictures from the post-Apollo missions. They look for any landscape surface feature similarities that they can find between these post-Apollo missions and the Apollo missions. And they say, oh, look, it's photographed the same. They've pictured the same area that we saw in the Apollo program. That's proof that they went to the moon. Well, they ignore these pre-Apollo missions, which photographed these images down to 1 meter resolution. And, you know, so NASA, they already knew what the surface was going to look like, so all they would need to do is simply model their sets and props, you know, using these vast images as a reference. And, in fact, they did just that during their training, their training for the alleged missions to moon. They had set off bombs in Arizona to recreate parts of the moon. There was a documentary, The Planets, by the BBC. You can look that up. They showed videos of them detonating the bombs. And when you overlay that landscape scene from the air with the pictures from Lunar Orbiter, looks exactly the same. They did something similar outside, I think it was Edwards Air Force Base. And they also, at the Langley Research Center, they build scale models of the moonscape with these giant cranes to, you know, simulate, you know, touchdowns and the like. And yeah, so they knew exactly what the landscape was going to look like. And I recently learned this. In fact, many propagandists have tried to say, oh, well, these pictures, they don't look as good as the modern ones. Some of them are too fuzzy or this or that. Well, I recently learned that the Lunar Orbiter pictures, right, the ones that were released to the public at the time, they were all filmed, all photographed off the screens, just like how they filtered the Apollo TV telecasts. They did the same thing with Lunar Orbiter. They filmed the images off the TV screens, and that's all they ever released it to the public. Recently, right, they found a group of people. They found a whole bunch of older archival unfiltered reels of all the data from the Lunar Orbiter missions, right? And they've been digitizing the pictures, and the landscape is just unbelievable in quality and everything else. It is much clearer than what we saw back in the 1960s, what they had released. And so it's clear that NASA had the photographs capable of resolving the landscape in advance.
Well, if you're getting it down to 1 meter resolution back in, did you say 66? Did you say 67?
Yeah, 66.
If you get down to 1 meter resolution on the moon, how come there's no high res photos of the moon proving that we went there 50 years on?
Yeah, that's a whole other story and stuff. The Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter has been constantly cited as independent verification for Apollo. No one seems to understand the word verification. If you're a propagandist, you don't seem to understand the word independent, right? Because the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter is a NASA probe, and here's the thing, right? The images, first of all, they're sent as encrypted pictures. One claim that I heard people say was, oh, well, anyone can just tune into this probe from the moon and get the pictures themselves, see them in real time. Well, no. The images that it sends are all encrypted files, so you could receive the data, but you couldn't make heads or tails of it, right? Those pictures are received by NASA's White Sands Tracking Facility, and then they're passed on to NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, and then finally they're passed on to Arizona State University. Right, and so this elaborate game of pass the parcel would obviously give NASA the opportunity to photo manipulate the images before finally handing them over to Arizona State University. Assuming, of course, ASU aren't a part of the conspiracy too, because in one of my videos I showed that they had a much wider picture of one of the Apollo 17 images that they released. They used the wider image in one of their promotional videos, but all they released was just a tiny little cropped area that showed a narrow I don't know, 100 meters or so, to a portion of the landscape, which showed the okay, here's what they're calling the module. Here's what they call is the rover. It's all pixelated junk. And if you look at the video, which shows a much wider area, you can see that the rover tracks, they conveniently end just beyond the border of the published area of the image.
And so yes, I've seen that. It's incredible, yeah. Isn't it?
I have a whole documentary about that.
I mean, you know, just to summarize the LRO evidence, it's rubbish. And I really mean that, you know, accurately. With all due respect, it is rubbish in terms of it being evidence that human beings went to the moon. And I will stand by that. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. We'll be right back. Don't go away. Radio Australia, and we're into the last segment of the second hour now. This show has gone really fast tonight, and we've just sort of glided over this topic, and you know, we've touched on many things. It's always like this when we approach a subject like as big as this, that it's very hard to feel we've really made any progress. One thing, Jarrah, I would actually like to address in the time we've got left is your interest in the quest of human beings to leave this planet. Because I know you believe we can do it and you believe we should do it. Would you like to actually talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I believe that the radiation problem could be solved by the company SpaceX. They're proposing building the minimum shielding requirements that you would need to protect yourself from the Van Allen radiation belt and the solar flares would be 2 meters of water shielding. If you had 2 meters of water shielding surrounding yourself, right, and you traveled through the radiation belt, the dose would be reduced to only 1 rem per day. Right, and so there wouldn't be much of an issue anymore. And so the
how would we get so much water up into space?
Well, the group SpaceX, one of the proposed rockets they're planning on building was called the Falcon 20. Okay, this rocket could lift 140 tons. Okay, so 140 metric tons. Now I did the math. If you have a spherical cabin 2 meters wide and surrounded by 2 meters of water, that works out to be something like 109 tons. Okay, so then of course you need a shelter module. All the proposals for deep space missions, they propose a comfortable living quarters, relatively lightweight, and a thick, heavy shelter module that you would transfer to during the radiation when it gets too high. And so the idea was you'd go to the shelter module. So you've got the Dragon spacecraft, which SpaceX, they say, can make propulsive landings onto any body in the solar system. In fact, they plan on using it to make a propulsive landing on Mars. You know, you might have heard about the Red Dragon program that they've been proposing, right? I honestly wonder if they had seen my Mars Faker series, because in that video series I demonstrated, Renee brought this up first of all, he mentioned that the Mars atmosphere is way too thin to support parachutes, and you know, so it wouldn't have worked. The parachutes would not have worked, is what they've claimed to have done on all the Mars missions. And so, whereas SpaceX, they're relying on not using any parachute. They want to make a propulsive landing onto the Martian surface. And I wonder if they had seen my video. Now, the Dragon spacecraft, the shelter module, and the living quarters, that would weigh something like 131 tons. So what I propose is, if you had the Falcon 20, you could launch that into space. You launch this living quarters, this shelter, and this Dragon spacecraft into Earth orbit, right? That just gets you into Earth orbit. Now you'd need a second Falcon Heavy, preferably one with two additional first stages of side boosters. That would triple the lifting capacity by three times. Okay, that would be plenty to get the upper stage with all the fuel in it for the mission. The two would dock in Earth orbit and they light you off, go to the moon or go to Mars, wherever you want to go to. Okay, now I posted a video about that. You can look that up on my YouTube channel. It's called SpaceX Man on Mars for only $500,000 per person. Right, and that's the price tag that Elon Musk is proposing. Now, I posted that video based on all the educated guesses, you know, based on all the information that was available at the time, and I was pretty confident that this would be SpaceX's goal. But in November, I think it was of 2012. I think it was November 2012. Yeah, it was 2012. Elon Musk, he was giving a speech to the Royal Astronomical Society, and much to my dismay, he said, "Oh, well, there's many people talking about you just need several meters of water surrounding yourself, but you don't need that. You can just have a column of water, and you keep that column pointed to the sun." Basically, he's saying we just need to shield one side of the spacecraft and keep that sheltered area pointed to the sun. And that's not going to work because the sun has a magnetic – a lot of people think that solar flares are directional. In fact, that's one of the things that the pro-NASA CIA people claim. That's not, you see, because the sun has a magnetic field that deflects these solar particles in all directions. That's why you need to have the radiation shelter surrounding the entire capsule, or at least surrounding the entire module that you retreat to.
Okay.
And so I sent Elon Musk's videos about that. I sent him links to an article that showed a flare that was pointed away from the sun was deflected at the Earth. That was just recently. I forget the exact month right now, but I sent Elon Musk the links to that on his Twitter account and everything else. And I sent him my video. I sent him this. I sent him that. And he didn't respond. But just 1 month after I told him this information, he went on the record to say that the radiation problem needs to be solved before we send humans to Mars. Okay. So first of all, 2 months ago, he said that we just need a column of water on one side of the ship. I tell him, no, that's not going to work because the radiation comes from all sides. And then a month later, he says, we need to solve the radiation problem. So I sincerely hope that he's realized his mistake and will rectify the shortcomings of his proposal.
Wow. Jared, can I ask, when are you due to finish your degree?
There's a few more years to go, and I plan on posting the graduation videos on YouTube for all eyes to see.
I'm looking forward to it, and it's going to be. I've been really looking forward to talking to you. You know, a couple more years. I mean, this show, Truth News, we're in for the long haul, and you are as well. And time will tell. You know, with all this kind of stuff, it's very hard to control people's desire to know what is really going on in this world. Well, we've got a few minutes left. Damon, you've got a few things there.
One more, a couple of things. One, we forgot to mention Operation Starfish, where they let off atomic bombs in the upper atmosphere, I believe, in a desperate attempt to find a way through the Van Allen radiation belts by suspending the particles and allowing them to go through. But that backfired enormously, and I think to their amazement, the entire atomic blast, which was a very reckless, careless, demonic thing to go and do, was absorbed by those trapped particles in the radiation belts. Look, I don't know, Jared, do you want to comment on that Operation Starfish? And
well, I haven't looked at much of the Starfish Prime or the things in general, but it's funny. I was actually reading some of Eric Chacon's book, The Hubble Wars, just before the show, just a few hours ago. He actually mentioned on, I think it was on page 75, about how some of the early Starfish Prime and also the Operation Argus launches, when they were firing just the small ones. He mentioned how he believes that some of these explosions could have been responsible for the South Atlantic anomaly.
Yeah, that's interesting. And also that the charged particles were charged to in an order of 100 times. So the radiation measurements we're talking here, which are pretty extreme, imagine, 1,300 rem per hour multiplied by 100 because some idiot decided to let off an atomic bomb in the upper atmosphere.
Absolutely. Jared, have you got any comments on the Chinese space program?
Yes, actually, a lot of people have been asking me that, and I've been analysing the Chinese have been rather cagey with the photographs because a lot of the photographs that they've released have been photographed off the TV screens, and I've constantly been waiting for the unfiltered images. But one thing that really does stand out, and I'm actually looking at the pictures right now, is that the pictures of the actual Chang'e rover, right? In one picture, the landscape is correctly exposed, and the shadowed side is very, very dark. Right? Some of it's in pitch black. And in order to illuminate the shadowed side, they needed to open the iris up to the aperture up all the way to the point that the landscape is mostly a wash of white light that you can barely make out any surface topography anymore. Okay, and this is an agreement to what I did with my experiments, and also a couple of Russians. I forget their names right now, but they're mentioned on David Percy's website. They repeated the MythBusters experiment, and they showed that with a surface reflectivity same as the moon, which is only 7%, right? You cannot get the enough sunlight, or in this case, artificial light, reflected onto the subject, onto the shadowed side of the subject. Yeah. It just doesn't reflect enough light. And so the Chinese photos are in agreement to my experiments. And another thing that everyone has seems to be commenting on is that the landscape looks very, very different color-wise to the Apollo program. On the Apollo pictures, it was all very, very gray. Yeah. In the Chang'e surface images, I do stress that some of them have been photographed off the TV screens and stuff, but of the most cleanest unfiltered images that I could find, the surface is very, very dark brownish gray in color, and there's also some white rocks scattered around it. It looks like pumice, actually, and it just doesn't look anything like what we see in the Apollo program pictures.
Well, what about stars, Jarrah? Are there any images of stars from the Chinese rover images?
Not that I can see in these pictures, but the probe does carry an astronomical telescope which is designed to photograph the stars. And they said that they should be able to photograph the stars in the infrared. I'm not sure if it has a visible light thing on it, but they say it can photograph them in the infrared. The only images from the Apollo program to contain stars was this one UV telescope camera that they allegedly brought to the moon on Apollo 16, and the pictures are just all smudgy and blurred and everything else. They don't really reveal the stars in all their glory. I've seen much, much better pictures, even in the infrared. Ultraviolet. I've seen much better ultraviolet pictures of stars taken from Earth orbit, and they're vastly superior to any of the pictures that they had on Apollo.
Yeah, the whole question about stars, I know there's been a lot of debate back and forth about it. I mean, because there's no glare, there's no atmosphere, you should be able to point the camera up into the sky if you're on the moon, as long as it's pointing away from the sun, and take quite a sharp image of stars. Would that be correct according to your point of view? Imagine if Neil Armstrong had kind of laid down on the ground and pointed his camera up, the camera was on his chest, up, you know what I mean?
I've done a whole heap of experiments like that, and just a few months ago, I was trying to look out for the asteroid that was supposed to fly by the Earth. I forget what it's called right now, but I did the shots, and I got, this was with a daylight exposure setting, I was able to record Alpha Centauri and four of the five stars in the Southern Cross. That's on my YouTube channel. You can see that.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Look, we're just getting to the end of the hour. It's been really, really great having you on, mate. Really, really good to have you back on the show.
Pleasure to be here.
And we will follow your progress. And I hope you release some more videos to YouTube soon.
Will do.
Because I need it, you know, like it's my fix. It's my fix. Okay, that's it for Truth News Radio for this week. It's been great bringing you the show. And we'll be back next week. See you then.